God save the United States and its honorable court.
Good morning, Mr. Smith.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Greg Smith, and I represent Dr. Mansoor Salomon, the appellant. This case should be remanded for a resentencing. The pure question of law before this court is whether vulnerable victims under 3A1.1 must be victims under 2B1.1 when the offense or relevant conduct is controlled by 2B1.1.
Now, the Third Circuit said those are separate inquiries. You want to link them together. What's your response to the Third Circuit saying, we're not following logic here, right? We're just following language. And where does that lead you?
Well, I don't think there's any language that requires them to be separate, and there's nothing in the guidelines that specifically says they should be separate. There's no definition of victims in 3A1.1, and Judge Griffith, and more importantly, the whole idea of the sentencing guidelines is consistency. This would be creating two different definitions of victims without any separate definition set forth in 3A1.1. Even if it could be applied in some context, moreover, where the offense is governed by 2B1.1, the definition of victim in 2B1.1 ought to be applied. We shouldn't have two separate universes of definitions of victims when there's no reason to think that was what was required. And I recognize the Third Circuit clearly says it. You're right. If you follow the Third Circuit, you're going to go the other way. But the Third Circuit said that it defied, they acknowledged that what they were doing defied logic.
You don't dispute that the children here were vulnerable victims under 1B1.3, right? I mean, under the all acts omissions that cause harm, they would fall within that, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not? Why?
Well, I acknowledge they're vulnerable. We don't contest the vulnerability. But it doesn't say vulnerable persons in 3A1.1. It says vulnerable victims. And it also, more importantly, in Application Note 2, it specifically says...
But I thought what we learned from 1B1 is that when you're looking at adjustments, when you're looking at a base offense level and you're looking at adjustments, that we're not looking simply at the definition of a victim in the definition of the offense. That we're looking at something broader than that. We're looking at someone who was harmed as a result of all acts that occurred during the commission of the offense. And these children were harmed during the commission of the offense. They may not be the specific victims of identity theft, but in this larger sense, weren't they the victims of harm that occurred during the offense?
Your Honor, I guess I'd respond in a couple of ways, the most significant of which is I think that it would be precedent-setting and unusual, I submit, for this court to establish one standard of relevant conduct in Chapter 2 and a different standard of relevant conduct in Chapter 3. The implications of that could be broad and could apply in ways unknown to a number of different cases. Here, 3A1.1 in the application note specifically says that vulnerable victims are victims who are accountable, whose offense conduct and relevant conduct is something that is accountable. It defines vulnerable victim as a victim of the offense of conviction and any relevant conduct for which the defendant is accountable. Under Chapter 2, the defendant was not accountable for these other people.
It doesn't say accountable under Chapter 2. It says for which the defendant is accountable under 1B1.3. And if you look at 1B1.3, it says adjustments in Chapter 3 shall be determined on the basis of the following: all harm that resulted from acts or omissions specified in A1, which is all acts and omissions committed by the defendant that occurred during the commission of the offense of conviction. Not that are the offense of conviction, but that were committed during the offense of conviction. And when you say that it would be odd to have a different definition of victim for one or the other, 2B1.1 expressly says that its definition of victim applies for purposes of this guideline, not for purposes of all the guidelines. So I don't, I'm, I guess I'm following the text exactly, and I don't see how we get to your result.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there's nothing specifically in the guidelines that says that they should be read inconsistently.
Well, what's inconsistent about it? The guideline specifically says this is the definition only for this guideline. So it's not inconsistent to read it differently. It's doing exactly what the guideline says.
Well, it would be reading vulnerable victims as if it meant vulnerable persons, I submit. There is no other definition of victims.
It says any loss. It says anybody who suffers any loss.
No, Your Honor, I understand. I guess what I would submit to the court is that I think that the victim, the only definition of victim in the guidelines is the one contained in 2B1.1, and particularly in a case where the offense is governed by 2B1.1.
What if the offense weren't covered by 2B1.1? What if it were some other section?
I think that would be a harder question for the court.
You just said there's only one definition in the whole guidelines of a vulnerable victim. Are you saying that 2B1.1 should apply even to non-economic crimes?
I don't think that question is before the court.
Well, I appreciate that, but if we adopt your logic, is that that's the only section that has it, is your position that you have to apply that even for a crime that is not economic?
I think you could apply it, and then it would be fairly applied
I don't think it has to be. If it's the murder of somebody who we would all describe as a vulnerable victim, you would say they're not vulnerable because there was no economic harm to the victim?
Well, there would be bodily injury to the victim, so it would fall within 2B1.1.
What if it was only they only scared the person?
Well, Your Honor,
they shot 55,000 times right by the head of the victim, who was a young child, didn't either commit bodily injury to the person nor economic injury, and it's not a Section 2 crime, right?
I understand. I guess what I would say to the court, I understand what you're saying in terms of the equities involved.
I'm not, no. Then you don't understand what I'm saying, because I'm not talking about the equities. I'm talking about the words of the guidelines and the structure of the guidelines, which apply a rule of relevant conduct which is different than the offense conduct.
And that was done even in Chapter 2 here. Under 2B1.1, my client's Chapter 2B1.1 adjustments were not limited to his offense of conviction. His offense of conviction was one person's name who he used in the identity theft. He got hit with the number of victims related to all the people who were subject to his act. So it's not like it was limited to the offense of conviction. The Chapter 2 adjustment applied to all relevant conduct. But if there are concerns about the fairness of how this might apply, say with a murder victim or the example you gave, the answer is to, if you think that 3A1.1 doesn't cover it all, is to upwardly adjust or depart. The issue is not to...
I appreciate there are a lot of things that could have been done here. The judge could have said, I'm giving you this sentence under my discretion without respect to the bump. I appreciate that, but that's not what we're talking about here. Is your position that this is not relevant conduct at all, or just that they're not vulnerable victims under the definition?
My position is that the same relevant conduct ought to apply in Chapter 2 as in Chapter 3. That's my position, that Chapter 2 defines the scope of the relevant conduct. You can't use one standard of relevant conduct in Chapter 2, 2B1.1, and in a different one in Chapter 3.
So the only kind of conduct that can be relevant is an economic conduct?
Or bodily injury as defined in 2B1.1. Yes, they have to. My position is that the people that fall within the rubric of victims as defined in 2B1.1,
I'm not talking about the victim.
Limits the universe of what can
right,
be.
I'm not talking about the victim bump. I'm talking about the right of the judge to consider relevant conduct in the context of sentencing somebody for that offense. Is the judge only allowed to look at an economic offense, or are they allowed, as the language says, any conduct committed during the course of the offense of conviction?
My position is that when Chapter 2 narrows the scope of the relevant conduct and what is relevant conduct, that you can't go beyond that when you move to Chapter 3 in an offense that has been narrowed within Chapter 2.
All right, let me just, another question I had about my understanding of your position. Is your position that the meaning of the language that says the offense of conduct and relevant conduct means you have to do both, that it has to be both, or do you agree with Zatt's case that you can that the victim does not have to be the victim of both the offense and the relevant conduct, leaving aside the particular problem here?
Well, it was, a strict construction application would mean it would have to be both. I recognize that they found that it was a mistake by Congress. I think it depends on whether you're a strict constructionist or not. I think if you're a strict constructionist, it would have to be both. But obviously, the Zatz case was...
Was then Judge Roberts a strict constructionist when he said that it didn't have to be both in Smith?
I guess he was not.
Judge of this court, so it's a precedent for us, whether he was strict or not, right?
I don't think the issue was raised in the Smith case. But nevertheless, Justice Alito was in the panel, I think, in Zatz. He's about as strict a constructionist as there is, and he wasn't bothered by that. So even a strict constructionist apparently found a way around the language.
Let me ask you, Judge Griffith asked you about one of the other circuits. I want to ask you about two other circuits, the 9th and the 11th. You cite these page 11 of your reply brief. This is the Haggard case and the Yount case. So isn't Haggard really directly on point? This is a case where the court holds that by the words of the provision, no nexus is required between the identity of the victim and the elements of the crime charge. The guidelines specifically instruct the district court to take into account in adjusting the defendant's base offense level all harm the defendant causes. And similarly, in Yount, court says the vulnerable victim provision does not require a vulnerable victim who is a victim of the offense of conviction.
Well, I think they were both pre-1995 amendment cases, Your Honor.
And what was the purpose of the 1995 amendment? 1997 amendment.
I'm sorry, 1997 amendment. The purpose was to take out the targeting requirement, and as the Anderson court found,
so you agree that if those cases were the rule, you would have a big problem here.
If I would acknowledge that if we were still acting under the pre-amendment regime, yes, we would have problems.
Well, I'm sure you must have read the actual amendment, Amendment 564, and I'll read it to you.
521, I think, Your Honor.
Well, what about 564, which is the one that added the language and any conduct for which the defendant is accountable? That's the one that creates the guideline as we have before us today, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so it says, I'm reading from page 523 of the guidelines manual, and this is what Judge Roberts cited in his opinion in Smith. This amendment addresses a circuit court conflict regarding whether a victim of the offense in 3A1.1 refers only to a victim of the defendant's offense of conviction, or more broadly, to a victim of any relevant conduct. The amendment adopts the majority appellate view, which holds that a sentencing court should consider the defendant's relevant conduct when determining whether the vulnerable victim enhancement applies. See, for example, United States versus Haggard, Ninth Circuit, 1994, that it is proper to consider harm caused to victims beyond the defendant's offense of conviction, and United States versus Yount, 960F2nd, 955, 11th Circuit, 1992. It seems to me that the purpose of the amendment was to adopt the proposition in Haggard and Yount, which you say doesn't apply because it was before the amendment.
Well, Your Honor, my response would be that
no genius would have found this.
No, I understand.
The reason we find this is because it's referred to. It's the basis for our opinion in Smith.
Well, I understand, Your Honor. The point I would make is I'm not taking the position that you don't consider relevant conduct under 3A1.1. That's not my argument. My argument is that when you consider relevant conduct, you consider relevant conduct as it has been tailored, as the parameters have been defined under Chapter 2. You don't use a different standard of relevant conduct in Chapter 2 that you do in Chapter 3.
3A1 requires two conditions to obtain, right? One is the relevant conduct, but the other one is that the victim has to be the victim of the offense of conviction, right? What does that mean, victim of the offense of conviction? Offense of conviction is the third count here, right? What does it mean to be a victim of the offense of conviction?
Well, in this case, there was one doctor whose name was used on the prescriptions, and I think they would have to link it up to the offense
of conviction. You have to argue that the children were not the victim of the offense of conviction, right?
I don't think there's been anybody arguing that the children that the lower court found to be vulnerable were linked to the offense of conviction.
Why does that have to be? The language is the victim includes any person who is the victim of conviction and any conduct for which the defendant is accountable. And since, as you know, we've read and basically as or, that means victim of the offense of conviction or the victim of any conduct for which the defendant is accountable.
And I think that's the argument the government is making, is that it falls within relevant conduct. I don't think anybody's arguing it falls within the offense of conviction. I understand what the court is saying. If you read and to mean or, then they have an argument to make. If you don't read and to mean or, clearly the decision below was incorrect. But even if you do read it as or, where you're allowed to consider relevant conduct, the meaning of relevant conduct ought to be the meaning as it's been established within Chapter 2.
Right, that's the way I read your briefs originally. I didn't understand you to be saying that and doesn't mean or. At least you didn't argue that expressly. Is that your position? Because that really does seem that if we were to take that position, we would be in direct conflict with numerous other circuits. And I believe we'd be in direct conflict with Smith. Yeah. I understood your position to be that even if we read it as or, you still have to use the Section 2 definition. Am I misinterpreting you?
Your Honor, I think that the language is before the court. It's fair to say I didn't emphasize that as the primary argument in the case, certainly.
Okay.
I've gone beyond my time.
I understand. I guess I'm wondering why this case got to be so hard. That is, forget about the children. Almost all these victims are psychiatric patients. The government's position was in its sentencing memorandum that significant numbers of them paid one way or the other, through co-payments or the other. Why would they not be the vulnerable victims, and why wouldn't their co-payments, even if tiny, leave them as vulnerable victims?
Had they linked the vulnerable people that they identified to co-payments, it may have been a simple case. But the government didn't present that evidence below, and therefore our position is...
Their brief below says... just trying to find it. Something along the lines of that there were 68 patients who lost money.
All at one clinic. And my understanding is that the vulnerable people they identified were from the other clinics.
Is that right?
That's what the government, I think, said in its brief, but I'll let them answer that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Apperson?
May it please the Court, Jay Apperson for the United States. Your Honor, if I may address your last question.
I found the page. It's page 7 of the sentencing memorandum. It says more than 68 patients paid money themselves, either wholly in co-payments for the same.
None of those were the five vulnerable children. The vulnerable children were essentially wards of the state. They were in foster care. They'd made no co-payments. They had been bounced around through the system. That's what established their vulnerability. So they were not financially harmed.
Aren't the other patients... Okay, well, at least that clears up that you weren't making the argument. But I don't understand. I thought that... Almost, your reference to almost all the patients is that they were all receiving psychiatric care, right?
All of the vulnerable.
Well, not all the patients. I thought the idea was that most of his patients were receiving psychiatric care or drugs for psychiatric reasons or something like that. Not so?
Well, he certainly was prescribing both controlled substances and non-controlled substances on fraudulent signatures beyond the five vulnerable patients. That would include the 68th, there's no question, Your Honor.
But you weren't making the argument, and the definition of vulnerable victim includes because of mental reasons.
Correct.
But you weren't making that argument. You were focusing only on those five? You weren't making that with respect to more than the five?
Well, the court found that at least with respect to the five identified by the government, those were the children, juveniles that I described. That's who the court found. The district court made a finding that those at least were the vulnerable victims. And there's been no dispute by appellant that they were as to their vulnerability with respect to that. But they were, to be clear, it was never alleged by the government that any of those five suffered a financial loss.
Okay.
Your Honor, with respect to appellant's claim, there's not a single case that has held that a vulnerable victim under 3A1.1 must also be a victim as defined by 2B1.1.
If all we were looking at, however, was the definition of a vulnerable victim under 3A1.1, it does say and, right? Let's forget Smith, but the language of the definition of vulnerable victim says a victim of the offense of conviction and any conduct for which the defendant is accountable under 1B1.3.
It does, Your Honor. But that's
so how are these children a victim of the offense of conviction?
Well, they're a victim because, as Your Honor noted, the application note says a victim of the offense of conviction and any relevant conduct.
That's
and offense of conviction is the statutory offense.
Title
18.
It's count three here, right?
Count three here.
And count three, as it's described here, is the identity theft, right? Stealing Dr. TM's identity to write prescriptions for controlled drugs. Now, how are the children the victim of that offense?
Well, because they are the direct victims of that, because they are the people for whom he prescribed the controlled drugs. They are, if anything, in this case, they are the direct victims of the offense of conviction, because the offense of conviction is stealing.
Was there evidence that they were harmed by the prescriptions that were given to them?
They were harmed because they were harmed because they were entitled to have a licensed doctor with a proper DEA registration to administer controlled substances, treating them as a psychiatrist. This guy was not a licensed doctor. He was not a psychiatrist.
But he was
treating them as, so in that sense, they were
harmed.
But
the definition of victim under the statute is that it's someone who has to suffer pecuniary harm or bodily injury. Did they suffer either of those?
No, Your Honor. With respect, that's not true. There is no statutory requirement. The only definition of victim, as you're alluding to, is under 2B1.1, which clearly states, for the purposes of 2B1.1, victim is defined as you just described. Appellant wants you, this court, to rewrite application note 2 and strike out offense of conviction and insert is a victim as defined by 2B1.1. Well, there's not a court that has ever done that. This court should not do it. It is contrary to the entire directive of the guidelines that relevant conduct applies at every step of the way on determining the base offense level, determining the specific offender characteristics under Chapter 2, and determining significantly the adjustments under Chapter 3, the victim-related offenses. So that to account for all harm.
Let me ask you this. Why is the doctor whose identity was taken not the direct victim under 2B1.1?
He was a direct victim as well.
All right. So there's a difference, obviously, between him and the children and the patients who were prescribed these drugs.
That's correct.
And that, I thought, was your argument to allow you to go over to 3. Because I don't see how they're the victim under 2B1.1, under the offense of conviction. It's identity theft, and the doctor is the victim, or whoever's identity was stolen.
Well, Your Honor, the government prevails either way, because offense includes, under 1B1.1, offense includes relevant conduct. Whether they're direct victims of the offense of conviction,
right,
or whether it is relevant conduct relevant to the offense of conviction, the district court properly applied the relevant conduct under Chapter 3 to determine that the vulnerable victims, as defined under Chapter 3, and gave the appropriate enhancement.
Okay.
The guidelines are very clear and defined for specific, for 2B1.1, victim means one thing. For 3A,
so you're saying 1.1, this guideline means this particular guideline. It's not the guidelines in general. It's
absolutely, absolutely. You're right. The court, Judge Garland asked earlier about it. Were there other victims? There's no general victim definition anywhere in the guidelines. Other provisions, for example, in Part G of the guidelines, offense involving commercial sex, promoting a commercial sex act under 2G1.1, it has a specific victim definition there. Victim means a person transported, persuaded, induced, et cetera. So there are a few specific definitions applicable to particular guidelines in other cases. 2B1 is no exception. It provides for the purposes, and expressly so, for the purpose of this guideline. And yes, Your Honor, that means under 2B1.1, just as for the purposes of this guideline for 3A1.1 means for that provision. It's the only thing that makes any sense. The Sentencing Commission is certainly entitled to make
the... If there's no generalized definition of victim, how then can you support the point that you made to me before, that these children are victims in the sense that they were entitled to a psychiatrist and they didn't get a licensed psychiatrist?
Well, because we have a general notion of who's been harmed by any given offense. The guidelines are replete with references to victim. There are all kinds of specific offender categories throughout the guidelines, though it is not...
We just use common sense in that one, which is...
Use common sense.
Something we don't often use in sentencing guidelines.
Well, to be with respect to relevant...
That was supposed to be a joke.
With respect to relevant conduct, I think we do use common sense because the guidelines are crystal clear that it is to embrace all harm. And appellant's position would not embrace all harm. Far from it. It would leave people who are the most vulnerable in our society unprotected, and this individual not to be able to pay for his crimes when they are entitled, particularly as vulnerable persons, to have a doctor who is licensed and a doctor who is registered to prescribe controlled substance. This is serious stuff. They have been failed time and time again, and if appellant's provision prevails, society will have failed them again. I respectfully, unless the court has any other...
I know this is off subject, but it was still bothering me. On page 12 of the sentencing memorandum, the government sentencing memorandum, it says, The files are filled with examples of children and adults who needed the services of a licensed medical doctor. Over 200 patients saw Mr. Solomon, believing him to be someone who was authorized and capable of treating them. This group of victims, individually and as a group, qualify to be vulnerable victims. So it wasn't only the five that you were, it was the five who you were specifying, but it seemed like you were arguing that all 200 were vulnerable.
Your Honor, I had not understood that to be the case, but the district court made the finding.
Oh, no, this is from the government sentencing memorandum.
Yes, Your Honor.
That basically, it seems like you were arguing that all, I appreciate it's not you, but you as the government, was arguing that all the victims were vulnerable. But I take your point that in the end, you're not pressing that. So the issue comes down to the five.
That is correct, and the district court found just with respect, again, I said it at least with respect to these fives. If this case were to be remanded, my guess is that the government may wish to reopen that.
You all didn't make any showing of harm other than the generalized harm you were talking to me about. You're assuming that if there's an unlicensed psychiatrist who gives perfectly good medical advice, that the recipient of that advice is necessarily harmed. That's your argument.
Well, appellant has never contested.
I'm just trying to understand the statute better.
I think that is correct, though. I will note that one of the bases that this the fraud was revealed was because a licensed social worker identified appellant. Discovered that he was assigning, quote, bogus Axis I diagnoses to his juvenile patients. So I think there is evidence of actual harm, though that was never explored. This case did not go to trial. Indeed, appellant got a acceptance of responsibility reduction largely because he saved the government from going to trial and having to bring these.
But you think, on my hypothetical, an unlicensed psychiatrist who gives perfectly good medical advice is harming the recipient of that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Patients are entitled. That's why we have medical licensing procedures. Okay. Patients are entitled to a properly trained and properly licensed. This man failed his exams 15 times.
Can I ask you what is wrong with what I think my understanding of the government's position is? The offense of conviction is an identity theft crime, and the direct victim of that is the doctor whose identity is taken. But, and this is maybe where I'm wrong with what your position is, but you have Chapter 3, which is a generic victim-related adjustment, and it's connected to hate crime motivation or vulnerable victim. And that says if the defendant, in committing whatever crime he was committing, knew or should have known that the victims were, had this special vulnerability, then you go into this generic victim-related adjustment and use that for, if not the offense of conviction, at least relevant conduct.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that your position?
Absolutely.
Okay.
This court can affirm whether it finds that they were the direct victims of the offense of conviction or relevant conduct, because, of course, the offense of conviction includes relevant conduct as the guideline derives. It also triggers, under the application as you just went through, we get every way but Sunday.
Okay.
Every way to Sunday. We win.
All right. Thank you.
I thank the court.
Questions? All right, thank you.
We ask the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, why don't you take a minute?
I would just quickly note, count three is very narrow. It is a one-month period of time when he used another doctor's name. So the adjustment
but
that
but
was
he was able to write controls. He was able to write prescriptions because of the identity theft, right?
Yes.
And he wrote prescriptions for the children, right?
There's not a question of that. But I don't think that the ones that the district
and that's court, not harm?
Your Honor, I don't think that the court's findings related to the five individuals, which were the only ones they found, the lower
you
court.
You heard the government's argument. They say that their harm occurs necessarily when an unlicensed psychiatrist practices medicine. The recipient of that practice is harmed. You disagree with that?
Not under Chapter 2. Chapter 2's parameters of what a victim is would not include those people. My argument, fundamentally reduced to its core,
right,
is because, Judge Henderson, you talked about the direct victim is the doctor. Clearly under Chapter 2, they went way beyond that in finding all these adjustments because they looked beyond. They went beyond the offense of conviction to the relevant conduct. Every child, 68 victims, he got hit with a number of victims. All that was going way beyond the offense of conviction. The offense of conviction was broadened to relevant conduct under 2.1. What they're trying to do is to broaden it further to include every individual he touched under Chapter 3. And that's my argument. When Chapter 2 confines relevant conduct, you use the same confines as the universe. When you're looking at who the victims are under Chapter 2, that's the universe that defines who the vulnerable victims are under Chapter 3.
Another point I want to be clear about your argument. The argument that you made in the district court is that the kind of harm that can be considered here is only financial harm, or leave aside as bodily, the possibility of bodily harm. But you did not make, and the reason you make that argument is because you believe the judge is restricted to Chapter 2, right? You did not make the argument, which is reflected in some of these other cases, that there's no harm. The argument that was under discussion with Mr. Apperson a few moments ago, which was whether or not they were harmed by just having an unlicensed doctor. Nobody made that argument below. The argument wasn't not only that they weren't harmed by financial, they weren't harmed at all. Your argument was simply that the court can only look at financial harm. That's right, isn't it?
I don't know that we got into that level of specificity below, Your Honor.
You're not making an argument here that they're not harmed at all, and therefore they can't be considered victims in any sense. You're only making the argument here that they're not victims under Chapter 2 because they're not financially or bodily harmed, correct?
I believe my client gave perfectly good medical advice to the vast majority of the people that he dealt with. And it was in an area where no doctor was going, no doctor was willing to go.
I understand what...
I don't think he harmed them at all, the vast majority of these folks.
But that's not the source of the argument that you made with the district, that was made with the district court. No one in the papers or at the argument before the district court said, Your Honor, these people are not victims at all under any theory because they were not harmed at all. Right?
Your Honor, I don't think the question was posed, but no, we didn't get into that level of specificity. But I did argue below.
That's a broader argument. I mean, the argument you made, which is made at page 32 of the record material, which is page 10 of your sentencing memorandum, is that when the term victim is properly viewed in the context of financial losses, and I understand that argument. There is another argument, which was the subject of the back and forth here, which is whether or not they were harmed at all. But that is not a ground that was made before the district court. And I just want to be clear about that, because if it had been made before the district court, then maybe the district court could have made findings about whether they were harmed in some other way.
Your Honor, the best way I can answer it is this. The government presented what I consider to be an extended legal theory. Their argument was we didn't need to discuss whether whether Chapter 3A and Chapter 2B needed to be reconciled. The court simply found that there could be some generalized, undefined definition of what harm was under Chapter 3, and it wasn't tailored to the confines of Chapter 2. Mm-hmm. In terms of common sense, Judge Griffith, you mentioned that the Kennedy court said that it defied common sense to think that somebody could be a vulnerable victim when they're not a victim under Chapter 2. And that's the bottom line. In a case governed by 2B1.1, I don't think you can have a vulnerable victim that doesn't fit within the rubric of a victim under Chapter 2. All right. Thank you very much.
And you were appointed by the court, Mr. Smith, and we thank you for your very able efforts.
Oh, well, thank you.
All right.